Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. The date is February 2nd, 2015. February is filled with birthdays of family members and old friends of mine, and so it always brings up, as soon as I realize I'm in February, I think, well, now I'm already on somebody's birthday pretty quick. And anyway, tonight is my subject is Europe, and the greatest threat facing Europe today, in my opinion. That is the effort led by Jews to get European Union members to sign on to a document named a European Framework National Statute for the Promotion of Tolerance. Now, does that make any sense? What is a European framework? What is a national statute? Well, it seems to me it's intended to fool you by using words this way, like national, which has nothing to do with national, and even European, because it's not Europeans who want it or find it necessary or who are behind this statute. So this document is not new, though. I want to tell you, I'm not the first person to be talking about this. It was making the rounds already in 2013 and started even a little earlier than that. And the whole idea has been around for quite a while, but it has taken on another gasp of energy for the 70th anniversary liberation of Auschwitz on January 27th, which just passed. Which is known as the Holocaust Memorial Day, the international one. So I thought I would talk about it, and I will go into it in much more detail after I say a few words about a few other things. And I want to say first that I am qualified to be concerned about Europe and this document because of my somewhat exalted standing of being genetically 99.8% European, according to the 23andMe DNA testing that I underwent recently. I got my results a few weeks ago, and I finally had the time to look at them closely enough. And so I thought I would tell you about it on this show, since the topic of today's show is Europe, and I've been wanting to speak about it. Therefore, let me go to that page. So I learned from this quite a bit of useful information, and I learned that I am not the most important part, but that I am in haplogroup H2, and as a matter of fact, I am H2A2. This is a group that has an age of 26,000 years. No, is considered to be in the region of Eastern Europe and Near East, but also Western Europe. It was the first complete mitochondrial sequence ever produced. It was from the H2 haplogroup. And elsewhere it says that in a little bit different way. But it's widespread. It's a very widespread migrations of the past few hundred years. Wait a minute. No, that's locations. I don't want to say that. All right, I'll read this. Haplogroup H, the parent of H2, originated in the Near East and then expanded throughout Europe toward the end of the Ice Age. Today, H is the most common haplogroup in Europe, especially in Scandinavia, where it is present in half the population. H2 is one of the older branches of H. Although concentrated in Turkey and in the Caucasus throughout its history, the haplogroup has made its way across Europe in two separate passes, eventually reaching the British Isles. Now, my ancestry composition came in on January 10th, 2015. Here's what I found out, and this is the important part. And they've got this cute little color circular chart thing and all this stuff to make it look pretty for you, but what only thing I like to just look at the figures myself, and I am determined by them to be 99.8% European, which is pretty amazing, I think. And I don't know that there's going to be too many people who match up to something like that. Obviously, there are. I was sort of, I was pleased. I wasn't really surprised because I thought, well, you never know what they'll, you know, what you've got in you that they can, that could be found. So I was pretty pleased with this, I must say. And it breaks down like this. They break it down into Northern European, Southern European, and Eastern European. And then something after that called Broadly European, because I guess they couldn't fit it into one of these three. So I am a majority Northern European, and it goes like this. 25% French and German, 5.7% Scandinavian. See, they have French and German combined there for me. So, but I'll explain that right now. I think that, I don't know whether, because what I'm thinking about is pretty recent, but I know that I have myself traced my ancestors to my more recent, you know, in the last 1,000 years or so, to the Western Germany, along the French border, so to speak, along the Rhine River, and close to, where the Alsace-Lorraine region would be. Sometimes it's been French, sometimes it's been German. It now belongs to France. So there are a mixture of French-German people there, and some French, some German, some mixed, and that's been going on for a long time. And then my most recent ancestors lived in Germany, in Baden, east of the Rhine, along there in the, I can't even think of the area. But it's in that area, so I'm not surprised that it would be French and German for that reason. So it says 25% French and German, 5.7% Scandinavian, 2.2% British and Irish, 0% Finnish. For some reason they put that in there. And then, in addition, this is not a total of those other numbers. This is an additional number, 34.9% broadly Northern European. So obviously they can determine only so much as to, you know, getting it down to the exact nationality or ethnicity, and it's not even an ethnicity, it's more of a nationality. And then some of it they just can't tell it that well, and so they put it under broadly Northern European. So that makes a 35 plus 25 plus 6, 7, 8, I didn't add that up, but that's the Northern European. So I'm way high on Northern European. Then the next is Southern European, the next most that I have, and that is 2.2% Balkan, 1.8% Iberian. That's the Spanish peninsula there, for anybody who doesn't know. 0.9% Italian, 0% Sardinian, why don't they add that, and 5.9% broadly Southern European. So that makes 6, 7, 8, 9, less than 10% Southern European. And Eastern European is the least, just 3.4% Eastern European. There's no specific nations mentioned. But what I'm very pleased about is that it does point out that I have 0% Ashkenazi. So that, I think, is another amazing stroke of good fortune for me. And I just can't praise and thank my ancestors enough that they didn't give me any Jewish Ashkenazi genetic material. And after being in Europe and Eastern Europe and Caucasus and all, coming all the way and all these, 25,000 years, they didn't mix with any Jews. Wow, I knew I didn't have any Jew, but, you know, from something way, way back, you never know, but that's what they tell me, 0% Ashkenazi. Good for you, Carolyn. And then they add, apart from the Eastern, Southern, and Northern European, they add 17.8% broadly European. So they had, broad, 34.9% broadly Northern European and 5.9% broadly Southern European and 17.8% broadly European. Again, where they just are not able. They don't have the tools yet, or maybe just 23andMe doesn't go that any more specifically into it than this. It would maybe cost too much. So this test costs $99 plus tax. It's it's pretty reasonable. And then these numbers all add up. All these numbers that I gave you, each one, they add up to 99.8. So what's left over in the other 0.2%? Well, half of it is broadly East Asian, and the other half is unassigned. So 0.1% broadly East Asian, 0.1% unassigned. I assume, again, that this part, they don't even have any idea where it comes from. It's something they're not familiar with or whatever. It's only 0.1%, so maybe it doesn't mean much. But also, I have 0%, as pointed out, of African. 0% African, 0% Native American. I don't have any American Indian in me. I knew that. I am 0% Oceanian and 0% East and South Asian each. So I'm really a pure European, mainly a Northern European. And it's no wonder that, I've never had any interest in other than Europeans to any great extent, never been attracted to them, never had, of course, I'm only talking about, because I'm a believer in reincarnation, so I'm only talking about this life. But anyway, Carolyn Yeager has no association with anything but Europeans, definitely, and thank God, no Jew in me. Now, I finally had time to do a little research, so I don't know how interested you are in this, but I'm going to go through some of it. It won't take very long. Maybe to encourage you to look into your background a little bit more. Okay, this haplogroup is my maternal lineage. For a woman especially, you only get the maternal lineage. I'm not real clear. I didn't have time to finish studying up on this, because we inherit traits from both our mother and father, but what was that word that they used? See, I've forgotten it. I'll probably come across it here somewhere. But what they go by here, it has to come down from the maternal lineage. So this is my maternal lineage, and the haplogroup H is the most common and most diverse maternal lineage in Europe, in most of the Near East in the Caucasus region. Haplogroup H possesses approximately 90 basal subclades identified to date, most of which further subdivided into other subclades. The most common are H1, H2, H3, H4, H5, H6. I already told you I was H2. H7, H10, H11, H13, H14, and H20. And the Cambridge reference sequence, that's what I said I was going to point out a little earlier. The Cambridge reference sequence, the CRS, that's the human mitochondrial sequence. And the mitochondrial is what is read here, which only comes down from my mother's line. I don't really understand that at all, why that is. But that's what they say. And this sequence is, all other sequences are compared to this Cambridge reference sequence, which is CRS. And the Cambridge reference sequence happens to belong to haplogroup H2A2A. And I am H2A2. Isn't that what I said? I have to check it. Yes, I am H2A2. So that is the sequence when they started that they used, and all other sequences are compared to this. Although I don't have that A on the end, I haven't been given that. They probably didn't go that far with this, but that one is H2A2A, And I am H2A2. I don't know what follows from there. Anyway, the development of the Neolithic lifestyle in the Fertile Crescent was about to bring a wave of Near Eastern immigrants that would change dramatically the genetic landscape of Europe. Think about, you know, what I'm going to be talking about in this program today is the end of Europe, if the Jews have their way. The end of Europe, our Europe, and us in it. And here, think about that while I'm reading this, about all the time it took for us to create this Europe and all that went into it. It's enough to make you want to cry, and it certainly, therefore, should be enough to make you want to fight for our European homeland. Goats and sheep were the first animals domesticated in the Taurus and Zagros Mountains some 11,000 years ago. The domestication of wild cereals could have taken place as early as 23,000 years before present in the southern Levant, although the actual cultivation of wheat and barley didn't start until 11,500 year before present. The first pottery produced in the Fertile Crescent appeared about 6,500 BCE, 6,500 years ago. It is from this period that early agriculturalists began expanding west towards western Anatolia and Greece. These Neolithic farmers potentially belonged to haplogroups H2, H5, H7, H13, and H20, as well as J2B1, KLA, NI, T2, and X2. All of which have been found in ancient Neolithic samples from Europe and are also found throughout the Middle East today. H2 was found throughout Europe and in the Caucasus. H2A, under H2A, I'm going to just read H2B. It says H2A1 was found mostly in Eastern Europe, the North Caucasus, and Central Asia. H2A2, that's what I am. Is found throughout Europe, and H2A3 is found in Kenya, El Molo. 4, it doesn't say, H2A5 is found in Norway, Ireland, Slovakia, and among the Basques. H2A5A is found throughout Europe. Okay, that's all the information they have on that. Well, here's a few little interesting facts. Some scientists reported that men belonging to haplogroup H have the lowest risk of asthenozoospermia, which is reduced sperm motility. So they have good sperm, the men in haplogroup H. And another study in 2005, that was 2000, another study in 2005 found that members of haplogroup H had increased chance of survival from severe sepsis at 180 days compared with individuals from other haplogroups. So the H group has good, I suppose, good immune system, good, strong, healthy ability to recover from very, very serious bacterial infections. Another study in 2010 found that haplogroup H was associated with a higher maximum oxygen uptake compared to other haplogroups. This would imply that the members of haplogroup H have a greater physical endurance during prolonged exercise. And they have a few famous people there, and I only wrote down the ones that affected me. Luke the Evangelist. Luke the Evangelist, one of the four evangelists whose presumptive remains in Padua were tested by some Veronese in 2001, is a H2A2B. I don't know about the B, but I'm H2A2. So there, I'm related to Luke the Evangelist. And Dr. Oz, actually his name is Dr. Mehmet Oz, the Turkish-American cardiothoracic surgeon, you know, that TV personality, who I don't care for because I found him to be extremely dishonest and also a promoter of Holocaust and all of that. But he is H2A1. I'm H2A2, so I'm not exactly from his group. But and the matrilineal descendants of Empress Maria Theresia were tested and confirmed to belong to the same haplogroup H. To belong to the same haplogroup, which was H, with certain mutations, which could be then H2C or H3. Well, I'm not H2C and I'm not H3, but anyway, she's in haplogroup H, not surprising. Once again, you always get the basic information that this haplogroup H indicates that it's common in Eastern Europe and the Caucasus, but likely, now here this is about H2, but likely spread from Western Europe because it is not found in significant frequency in the Near East. It is found in its highest frequency in Germany and Scotland. So there we go. They keep talking about Eastern Europe and the Caucasus, but that's where it started. I mean, that's kind of where it was, and so there's a lot of it there. But it spread to the west, and then they say it spread from the west back to the east. That's hard to know how they determine that. But they do say that H2 is found highest in Germany and Scotland. I would like to know more about that. I found a website where this man, the family name is George, J-E-O-R-G-E. Of course, there's several family lines, but they decided to use the George family line for their name here. And he's done a lot. He's in the H2 haplogroup, and he's done a lot of research. And I thought, I'd just go with his. Since he seems to be a pretty intelligent person and has done a lot of work on it. And I'm going to read some of what he wrote on his website. He says, interestingly, the H2 subgroup to which the George females belong is a relatively rare subgroup for Western Europeans and is found more commonly in Slavic peoples of Eastern Europe and Asia. In Western Europe, it is found at its highest frequency in Germany, Scotland, and Finland. Now, I don't have, my thing showed me that I don't have any Finnish at all, but yet this H2 is found in Finland. H2 is thought to have come from Western Asia near the Caspian Sea region and is one of the oldest, least modified branches. However, this does not mean its members stayed put. In 2008, for example, a 28,000-year-old skeleton was discovered in a cave in Italy, which was found to belong to H2A2. Hey, that's me. Now, there's a relative of mine. This 28,000 years ago, this poor fellow I don't know if he's a poor fellow. We don't know how he died, but his skeleton was in this cave all this time, and it was found, and he's in the same exact haplogroup as I am, H2A2. Groups of H were clearly moving into Europe by around 25,000 years ago, using a period of relative climate warmth. They spread rapidly to the southwest of the continent near modern France and Spain. This would make their arrival roughly contemporary with Gravettian stone culture, which that was a very advanced stone culture, and possibly even its source, possibly even the source of the Gravettians. This was the H groups 25,000 years ago moving and spreading around. But increasingly, colder temperatures and a drier global climate made living conditions nearly impossible for much of the northern hemisphere, and these early Europeans retreated south to warm refuges in modern Spain, Italy, and the Balkans. Various subgroups like H1 and H3 likely formed as these repeated migrations were cut off by the changing margins of the glacial ice sheets. It wasn't until after 15,000 years ago, when the ice had begun their retreat, that people moved north again to recolonize Western Europe. Populations of H2 in Western Europe might, in fact, be remnants of the earliest migrations out of Central Asia. I have a little, supposedly where H2 group started, and it was it's in between. Well, this isn't the one, but this is a map I've got here. It's a very strong, very solid in between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And then on the other side of the Caspian Sea and up north of there and just spreading out, you know, thinning out, this is a good area to live in, between these two seas. And I can't even see what these countries are, but, you know, we're around Turkey, Iran, what is now the Russian Federation, you know, and then over to the east, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and so on, which they weren't at that time. They were haplogroup H people, H2 people, especially. All right, now let me go on here. Then we have this thing about mutations, and I found out about some of my mutations, and I learned what was very interesting because it was what I already knew. So it's what I know to be true about myself, but there it was in my genes. And not even in my regular genes, because it appears that our genes give us everything that's functioning well, but sometimes there are what they call mutations in genes, and what they just don't work the way that they were intended to. They work differently. And what happens is that what was intended to be is not happening, and so you're kind of lacking something there. And that's... I'm still studying that, and I don't know if I have all of them from the place that I sent my raw data to, if they only gave some of them, or then I might have more than the few that they gave me, because they may specialize in a certain area. I kind of suspect that from reading more about it. So, but that you can learn all of that from your DNA test. You have to. There are websites that you can send it to. Some charge you and some don't. I just did the first one, the free one, and got a whole lot from them. I'm going to try one of these others that you have to pay next to see if they do the whole thing. Give me more than what the first one gave me. But it's not that much, you know, $20 or so. And they put it through whatever, and they can tell, because the raw data that you get is every one of your genes and every one of your synapses or something they call them, which shows what is not what it normally should be. And, you know, these can be pulled out real easily and looked at to see what they are. And they can determine all sorts of things about your health and your state of disease or not disease. So, and you can get all this on the internet without going to anybody especially to do it. Here's some perspective. I'm about done here, folks. Here's some perspective on that this Mr. George person wrote. And he said the original mother of haplogroup H2 would have lived about 1,250 generations ago, and her descendants would have followed woolly mammoths into Europe around 1,100 generations ago. That man in the Italian cave was part of a H2 generation, which lived to 1,120 generations, The great ice sheet started melting 600 generations ago, after which our ancestors helped recolonize Europe. The Kurgan expansion from Central Asia started 240 generations ago and reached France 120 generations ago. The Norman conquest of England and the Viking invasions were just 38 generations ago. So now I think I know that I was, my ancestry goes all the way back to that and was a part of all of this that was going on. I think it means that. So at least I know that this man in the cave in Italy, who was my exact haplogroup, and he lived 1,120 generations ago. So I go back at least that far. Well, it's very it's touching to think about all of that, all of those people, all of those lives and leading up to now. And this is what Adolf Hitler was always talking about, and the National Socialists were talking about, that to the German people, that all that went to make them, to bring them where they are today, and not never should they throw that away. And we are throwing it away today. Not that we want to, but we're being propagandized into doing it. Okay, now I'm into my dietary advice. All right, I'm going to go back to my other page, close this one. So that's what, let me continue with that just for a minute here, that there's such an immense investment that has been made in bringing us to what we are and where we are. And just the thought, when you look at this, when I have this information for myself, it brings it home so much more strongly than just the words that I've heard said so many times, and I believe them and go on with them, but that I would be throwing away all of that. Well, I didn't throw it away, but I haven't used it myself, so that's not good either. So there's all kinds of ways in which we have been encouraged to not continue propagating our wonderful genetics as the white European people. And this subject tonight is so very important. I just think it's vitally important, even though other people have talked about it, sure. But I just happened to see this very good article by Andrew Joyce at the Occidental Observer last week. And I thought this was, I read it and I thought it was the best article I had seen in a while. It got me all turned on and excited. The title is The News Titans on Europe. And it's already been passed around quite a bit by other people since, you know, he put it on Occidental Observer. And I was thinking I might read it, but I've got all the information I need, so I won't go through this. But he tells the story of this, does he have the name of it right on the front? He doesn't, but what I mentioned earlier, I'll come upon it here. Oh, and there's one part I want to read that he said, of this framework, European framework, natural statute for tolerance in Europe. A European framework, national statute for the promotion of tolerance. Well, you think I could remember that for more than 5 minutes, but no, I can't. He says of it, and what really struck home to me, and I liked it, because I like when people come out and say it as it really is, and don't try to, you know, don't misunderstand the danger that we're in and the seriousness of our situation. And Andrew Joyce says, when pursuing a group, he's of course following along with giving a lot of credit to Kevin MacDonald for his group evolutionary strategies in the books he's written and so on. And he says, when pursuing a group evolutionary strategy, perhaps the most sacred holy grail for the group would be legally preventing any discussion of the group. And he says, this new legislation would effectively signal the final defeat of the European struggle against the Jewish evolutionary strategy, since Europeans would relinquish their rights to acknowledge and question the interests, activities, and actions of other people as a group. The law will create a new crime of group libel, public defamation of ethnic, cultural, or religious groups. Padding comes in here, too, as women's and gay rights would also be covered. Well, he's referring there to the fact that their real intention of this is to stop all anti-Semitism and make it criminal, to stop all criticism of Jews as a group or in any way, but also as a group. So you can't say the Jews do this or the Jews are that. That would be criminal. Or you can't say it about any other group either. It's quite an insane piece of legislation here, and it's not really a piece of legislation yet. It's proposal or something that they want it to be turned into legislation. But he's pointing out here that one of the worst aspects of this is the criminalization of, well, two things. Either talking about people as a group, you can't do that. You can't say things about, I guess you can say nice things, but you can't criticize people as a group, and you cannot do what's called group libel. You can't libel a group. Well, I'll get into this in a little more detail here as I take it from my own notes. And he says that at the end of his article, he says that the release of the document has been expertly timed to coincide with the Jewish co-opting of the Charlie Hebdo shootings and the accompanying engineered panic about the status of Europe's Jews. And he says Europe is weak. Good for him for saying that. Europe is weak. It's weak to allow this kind of stuff to go on. It can hardly fight against these things. And we're going to, as I say, we'll look at it a little bit more. But here he seems to be suggesting that the Charlie Hebdo massacre, when it took place, was engineered to go along with for one thing, the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz that was coming up, and it was used extensively during that time amongst at the ceremony there in Poland to say that that's why we need new laws, we need to stop hate and so on. And I wrote an article about that, and I have a few things about that on carolynyeager.net. And I'm always interested when responsible people like this Andrew Joyce, that's a pseudonym of his for him, that's not his real name, whoever it is, but he's a darn good writer, and I think he's the one that has been my favorite for several years now. And the first thing I saw of his on Occidental Observer several years ago, I thought was so good, and I wrote and asked if I could, if they could pass my email on to him, inviting him to be on my radio program, and Kevin McDonald wrote back and said that he couldn't be on any radio programs because he was in under deep cover. Well, he does awfully good writing, and he's still doing just as well as he always did. So I do suggest if anybody who hasn't read that yet, go to Occidental Observer and read it. It's under the blogs, not under the articles. The blogs are called The News Titans on Europe. We're going to start with the sponsoring organization of this statute that's been written, and that is the European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation, also known as ECTR. It's a non-governmental organization that was established in Paris, France, on October 7, 2008, by Jews, of course, to monitor tolerance in Europe. All right? It's an organization set up in France in 2008 to monitor tolerance in Europe. But it has no official function. It's non-governmental. It sets itself up as a tolerance watchdog, very similar to the ADL. The ADL has self-appointed itself to monitor, well, it says tolerance, although it's really anti-Semitism, but it says it's for all people. They care about all people, just as this one does, and they appoint themselves to do this. And then they get real official looking because they have lots of money to pay for it and to get fancy logos made and so on, like this one that I used for the program announcement, and the circle, the blue globe-like circle with the outline of Europe on the upper part and the ECTR letters and the stars that are similar to, but not exact, not the same, but similar, and give the impression of the European Union. So this group of Jews wants to wants people to think that they are connected with the European Union, and there's no question about that because of their logo and then the things that they say. And it says on their on the Wikipedia page that they're focused on fighting xenophobia, anti-Semitism, and racial discrimination in the modern world. We're going to find over and over that when you look at any of these things that are set to that say that they're European and they use the European name and so on, and they're trying to make things better in Europe, it's always Jews behind it, and it's always Jews that are really fighting anti-Semitism. And then they add this other stuff to make it appear that they're not just Jews. And then they get some non-Jews to be on their boards or on their committees or what have you. But the main people is always Jews. So this says the main thing that they did in November 2008 when they were formed. They were formed in October. And in November, the ECTR was among the initiators and organizers of a series of events held as part of the European Week of Tolerance, whatever that is, on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of Die Kristallnacht, and International Day for Tolerance, which actually is a UNESCO day, the International Day for Tolerance. The UNESCO says okay to that, and has it on its calendar, I guess, probably once every year in November. And this is to link up with the anniversary of Die Kristallnacht, you see, and that's where the Jews have so much interest in that. Just like the one we just had was on the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. And it says here, in the course of official events, the ECTR presented a draft European Framework Convention on Promoting Tolerance and Combating Intolerance. This is the beginning of the thing I'm talking about tonight. This is where it started in 2008. And along with this, they presented a paper on concept for a white paper on tolerance. And this was presented to the European Parliament, which is the European Union body in session. So then this European Week of Tolerance that they came up with was actually co-organized by the ECTR, the European Jewish Congress, the European Parliament, they probably just said okay, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, the Russian Jewish Congress, the World Holocaust Forum Foundation, and the Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Remembrance Authority at Yad Vashem. Now this is pretty much a totally Jewish bunch of backers here that got this day, International Day for Tolerance, going, and they set up a European Week of Tolerance to go along with it. And who's behind it? Yad Vashem, are they European? They're Israel. That's Israel. And some of these Holocaust forums are not European. They're put on. They're under the auspices of Jews and Israeli Jews. And then there's the Russian Jewish Congress. Now Russia is considered European. Part of it is, but it's not a part of the European Union at all, and doesn't want to be. So all of this is connected with the European Union because it's accepted as a day and a week by the European Parliament and the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, which I assume is part of the EU too. And then all these Jewish groups. You see, that's the weakness. Of course, these are not. These are not our kinds of Europeans. These are the globalists who are behind all of this, and the Jews, and they work together. So, but it's really the Jews who are behind it, who want it to, and bring it into being. And we can see that this European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation, the chairman is there's two chairmen. One of them is the former president of Poland, Aleksander Kwasniewski. He was the president of Poland until 2013, I guess. And yet I read, looking him up, you can't find anything much about him, but I read on a forum, somebody said that he is definitely Jewish, and he changed his name. His name is Bronfman. He changed his name to Kwasniewski. That sounds Polish. Now, I can't say that that's true, but there that has been said. I wouldn't be surprised if he's going along, because he's going along with this Moshe Kantor, the other chairman, the other co-chairman. He is a president of the European Jewish Congress and also co-chairman of this council, the ECTR. And his name is Vladislav Moshe Kantor. He's Russian. He's a Russian Jew born in Moscow, obtained his degree from Moscow Aviation Institute in 1976. He's a businessman with a net worth of US $2.3 billion. And he's the 39th richest businessman in Russia. He's known worldwide for his fight against anti-Semitism and racism. And this man is all over the place. He likes to promote himself. He's a fat guy, but he must have a lot of energy because he's out there handshaking with all kinds of big-name people all the time. He's got plenty of money. He's friends with Putin, Vladimir Putin, but he's also one of the big oligarchs in Russia. But he's also friends with, or at least he poses for pictures, with European leaders. But, you know, he's Russian, and he's co-chairman of this thing that seems to want to present itself as connected with the European Union. There again, he's not connected with the European Union. But he makes it out that this whole thing, even this European framework that has been done under the auspices of the ECTR, is for the European Union. They want all the European Union to sign it, all the countries to have to submit to this, every one of them. And of course, the reason for that is that then nobody in Europe can be free from these horrible rules, laws, which I'll go over yet. You can't move to another country and get out from under it. If you're in Europe, you're stuck. You're stuck with it, and that's what they want. They want everyone trapped by these laws that they want to pass. And how they get away with it, you know, how decent European leaders wouldn't start yelling and shouting at them and kick them out and say and denounce this thing for what it is. But no, they don't. Everybody treats this man real politely and like he's special, and he has access everywhere and talks to everybody, and he's supposed to be a great humanitarian and so on. And he's just an evil Jew. And yet, they might say, no, we don't want to do that. We're not ready to do that. Our people aren't going to like that. But they don't expose it and get rid of it. The thing is that whether this thing passes, it probably won't. It won't pass and be enacted into anything at this time. But this won't go away. They won't stop. They never stop, do they? Until they get what they want. So it'll come back again and again and again, and every time there will probably be more people, more leaders in Europe who might go along with it, and more legislators who might vote for it because they'll be working on that too. So this is something to be extremely aware of and to try to destroy. It needs to be destroyed, and all these ideas need to be destroyed. And I've already shown, but I'm going to show more how this goes back. Every bit of this, all this kind of thing goes right back to Holocaust, and it depends on the Holocaust for it to even get as far as it's gotten, to be accepted as it is in amongst European leaders and so on, and others in the world too, but mostly this is for Europe, this particular thing. To I said, why don't these people, you know, denounce this man and denounce what he's doing, denounce this framework? No, why don't they? Because of Holocaust. Holocaust is what holds together the whole idea that intolerance is bad and that any kind of racial distinctions are bad, and we need to have multiculturalism because single race nations are bad. All of that comes from Holocaust, which is why we can't stop fighting Holocaust. We can't stop exposing Holocaust, and we need to do a better job of it even than we've done. There seems to me there's a place in the middle between the higher scholarship and kind of the lower level internet type making fun of it stuff, that we need a better vehicles for explaining to average people why it's wrong, why it's a hoax, why it didn't happen the way they say or anywhere close to it. So this needs to be done. I praise Kevin MacDonald and his Occidental Observer site, and I praise Andrew Joyce for the great work that he does. But they stay away from Holocaust there. And I've always said that, well, it's okay because everybody doesn't have to do it. But I'm starting to think that everybody does have to do it if we're going to get somewhere with it. Because if everybody's not doing it, it's too easy for people to hide away from it and say, well, that's not important. I think everybody does have to do it, because if everybody doesn't do it, we will never, ever save Europe. And I think I go along with Andrew Joyce that the end is near, that he said that this legislation would be the final defeat of Europe as the nation, as a continent of white people or European people. It will no longer be. It's already losing that, but that would signal the absolute end, and we're not far from it. So I think I will take a very short break and put on a short piece of music. I have here Morganland by Peter Schreier, when he was a young boy singer, shortly after World War II ended. And this is 2 minutes and 48 seconds long, so not too long, but we'll be back in under 3 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Thy green Lebanon, thou's Morgenland, ein Schämmer tief ist Jordanstrand, in Juda fragen und forschen die drei, wo der neugeborene König sei. Sie wollen Weihrauch rühren und Gold dem Kinde spenden zum Opfersalz. Und er grenzet des Sternes Schein, zum Stalle gehen die Künde ein. Das Knieblein schauen sie wonniglich an, bittend neigen die Künde sich. Sie bringen Weihrauch, Myrrhen und Gold zum Opferdar dem Knieblein.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Now, coming back to our topic, I had to do a little moving around, so I've been busy. Now, here's the history. Here's some more of the history of this ECTR. In October 2012, this Vyacheslav Moshe Kantor introduced the European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation's proposals for a general law of tolerance, which was presented at an official ceremony in the presence of European Parliament President Martin Schulz, as well as the two recipients of the European Medal of Tolerance. Well, see, the European Medal of Tolerance is just something that this ECTR came up with. And again, remember, it's a non-governmental organization, self-appointed group, has nothing to do with anybody, but they get in and they manage to, you know how Jews throughout the history managed to get friendly with kings and princes and dukes and wealthy people by being of service to them, helping them out, you know. Helping them with their finances, especially, and loaning not only loaning money to them, but helping them to figure out how to do things in a better way, in a more clever way, like the Jews know how to do, so that they could win, they could make more money, or they could win out over their opponents, whatever, even advise them in all kinds of ways. Be very helpful. And then eventually, they didn't ask for too much, but eventually they got positions of trust and authority, and then it took off from there. Well, that's the Jewish method of operation, and it still is. It always has been. And so this European Council of Truth of tolerance and reconciliation, it just goes around being helpful. You know, they just want to help these people in the European Parliament, and they want to help them put on events and take their part in it. And they'll just work like, you know, I'm sure that especially in the beginning, they'll just work very hard and be very helpful. And so he got in good with Martin Schulz. This Martin Schulz is a piece of work, you know, who ought to be gotten rid of. And he's a German who is obviously a big-time globalist, and he's the president of the European Parliament, which is the European Union Parliament, which members of the European Parliament, you know, all go to and get paid very well, too. They think they have a lot of money. The European Union has a lot of money. They spend a lot of money. As we know, they spend a lot of money on new countries that join, and look at all the money they've spent on Greece. Incredible. For what? For nothing. For getting nothing. But they want every nation in there. They want to be as big as possible because it's the global idea. So he was he presented his proposals at an official ceremony at the European Parliament, because Martin Schulz said he could, and they expanded on the model law for promotion of tolerance, a version of which it seeks to make mandatory now across all 27 member states. The chair of the task force in charge of its inception is Yoram Dinstein. He said that at this ceremony, Yoram Dinstein, who is another Israeli, said that tolerance is the glue that cements together the bond between distinct groups in a single society. This framework you can read as a PDF. I'll put it in the program notes, but it's all there. Although I think it's needs a little bit more work on it. They have a lot of explanatory notes there, but it's basically all there. At the end, it says that Yoram Dinstein is the chair of this, and Ugo Genesio, and Rain Millerson, Daniel Thurer, and Rudiger Wolfram are all members of this. And these are some pretty big names that this cantor has managed to put on this council to write up this framework. And here it says, Yoram Dinstein is he's a former president and a professor at Tel Aviv University is what he is. And why is he doing this European work when he's a Jew from out of Israel and not even connected with Europe? But I know that Israel considers itself to be European. It's very funny. First, you know, they consider themselves to be Middle East, and that's their home, and they're not European at all. And then on the other hand, they want to claim that they're European and that they're partners with Europe. So that makes it, you know, they have a big interest in Europe, and they have a lot of Jews living in Europe, and therefore they should be able to have a say in what goes on in Europe. But let me continue with this here. All right, Yoram Dinstein said that tolerance is the glue that cements together the bond between distinct groups in a single society. So, you know, he's from Tel Aviv University, but he's telling us how to bond together distinct groups in a single society. Of course, their object is to bring many different groups of people into Europe and then to say that this is good and that it has to be so, and then we need tolerance in order to bond us together, which, of course, it doesn't work, but that's another subject. On 17 September 2013, a subcommittee of the ECTR composed of Yoram Dinstein, Ugo Genesio, he's the former Supreme Court Justice in Italy, and I've been told also by somebody I saw somewhere where somebody said he was definitely Jewish, but he doesn't, on his formal pages like on Wikipedia and so on, it doesn't say anything about if he's Jewish or not Jewish. But when they don't say otherwise, it's usually a sign that they are. And Rhein Müllerson, who is some kind of a German, and Daniel Thurer, who is Swiss, and these two are, Daniel Thurer is a highly respected international law expert, and Müllerson is kind of a guy that goes along with things. And Rudiger Wolfram is another one who goes along with things. And they all presented a European framework national statute for the promotion of tolerance with a view to being enacted by the legislatures of European states. And they submitted this to the Committee on Civil Liberties, Justice, and Home Affairs of the European Parliament, you see. And so this is how they're able to do it. They form themselves into some kind of an organization, the ECTR, even though they just have invented themselves. And then they present papers to official bodies. And these official bodies look at the papers, you know. They have enough big names on there in order to make people take them seriously. It says here, some of the sections. Section 7 seeks to criminalize hate crimes, incitement to violence, group libel, and overt approval of a totalitarian ideology, xenophobia, anti-feminism, or anti-Semitism, amongst other offenses, and details that juveniles convicted of committing crimes listed above will be required to undergo a rehabilitation program designed to instill in them a culture of tolerance. You see how stupid this all is. It isn't even meant to work, because juveniles who are committing crimes, and a lot of them would be Arab, Muslim people, kids, that they're gonna learn tolerance in a rehabilitation program that they're sent to. And who's going to pay for all of this stuff anyway? But that's, and here again you see that anti-Semitism always comes in But they try to make out that it's not the main thing that they're concerned about. And then now they have this thing called anti-feminism, which is always next to anti-Semitism because it looks the same. So anti-feminism and anti-Semitism, then you just then see that anti-Semitism is bad too, just like anti-Semitism is, because they've got the public convinced that anti-Semitism is bad. And xenophobia, you know, this is also generalized. And they put in xenophobia. And so it's going to be a crime. You're going to go to prison for feeling xenophobic. What is xenophobia? It's a dislike of foreigners. It's maybe you don't want foreigners in your country. That's what it is. They call people xenophobic who say, I don't want these foreigners coming into my country. Oh, how terrible. It's one thing to make a moral judgment and to, as it's been doing all along now, to say that, oh, people who think who are that way are not nice people. They don't want to meet new and different people, blah, blah. But to make it a crime and to put people in prison for it, it's just outrageously almost, you can't even get your head around that. Then Section 8 states that the government shall ensure that schools from the primary level upwards will introduce courses encouraging students to accept diversity and promoting a climate of tolerance as regards the qualities and cultures of others. Now, this would be a law stating that in your schools from primary upward, which means even kindergarten and daycare, they bring it in there. They say encourage, but it would be to teach and force students to accept diversity. Because if they don't think that diversity is good, that then they're not nice people, and kids don't want to be seen that way. So everybody's going to be forced to think diversity is a wonderful thing. And diversity, the word diversity doesn't sound so bad, but if you have, let's say you have a diverse classroom and you have a lot of African students in there who behave very badly and make a lot of noise, but yet you have to be taught that they have a right to be the way they are, and you can be the way you are, but you have to accept the way they are. And they're going to dominate the whole class and others besides Africans who behave badly and can't learn and don't want to learn and disrupt the classroom and so on. But that's going to be acceptable because it already is so much in schools in this country too. Because you're not really allowed to judge these kids by your standards because they have their own standards, you see. And in their families and in their neighborhoods, they behave this way, so you have to tolerate that. This is it's a recipe for impossibility and for actually white people killing themselves. I mean, white people just shutting down and giving up because there's not going to be any space for them to even breathe or think well of themselves at all. So this is outrageously stupid. And then Section 9 states that the government shall ensure that public broadcasting television and radio stations will devote a prescribed percentage of their program to promoting a climate of tolerance. So part of this would be more laws that all public media or all media has to push this and have to devote a certain percent of their program, and that percent might even grow to promoting a climate of tolerance. So you see how truly Orwellian this is, and it's when you think about it, when you think beyond the nice sounding words, you know, the way it's written, it uses all those kinds of words that don't really have any meaning, but that sound official, that sound governmental, and that sound right, that sound like they're good. Now, I wanted to say that once again, because I can't say this enough, that this thing has, this I said came up in 2000, it was first in 2008, and then it came up in 2012, And it was associated with the anniversary of Kristallnacht, which they had a day of tolerance connected with that. And now it has come up again this in 2015 in connection with the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. So once again, we show that it's connected with the history of National Socialist Germany, the history of the Third Reich, the Holocaust, and Adolf Hitler, and all these things, which is the source and which is the basis for why they can say that all this is necessary. They use that. There's no way to get around that. You know, I have to say once again, because that's the theme of this program tonight, that there's no way to say, I'm tired of the Holocaust. I don't want to hear about the Holocaust anymore. Well, I'm tired of it. I'd like to not hear about it. But as long as they're going to play it up all the time and use it against us, then we have to respond to it. We do have to respond to it. Here's something from, I'm going to take some of this from the Guardian.com on January 25th. This article ran, called Jewish Leaders and something about Jewish Leaders in Europe Legislation Outlawing Anti-Semitism. Anyway, they say the panel of experts drafting the proposal includes a retired Italian Supreme Court judge, that's that Ugo Genesio, a former King College professor, well, I think that's Führer, and the former head of Germany's prestigious Max Planck Institute, that's Wolfram. No, not Wolfram, the other one, the other name I had there, Rain somebody. And, you know, the Max Planck Institute, prestigious though it is, was the one that where Germar Rudolph was getting his final degree. And when he went and investigated at the Auschwitz camp and came up with his theory about the chemistry of the blue staining on the walls, they kicked him out of school. They denied him his Ph.D., that he was had already earned. He was just, you know, it was just a matter of a very short time that he would be awarded it. They denied it to him. So they are in like Flynn with the whole evil crowd of I don't know who Max Planck was, but that's not a good place. And the chair of this panel is this Yoram Dinstein, who is a war crimes expert, supposedly. And he was a professor and a former president of Tel Aviv University. He is a professor there now at Tel Aviv University. And he has been the president of it. Now, why is he chairing? Only because he's a friend of Cantor, Moshe Cantor, and Moshe Cantor trusts him and knows he will do the job that he wants done. Now, why should somebody from Tel Aviv University be chairing this European framework, the writing of it, and the promoting of it and the selling of it and so on? And this Yoram, in defending the work that they've done on this, Yoram Dinstein says anti-Semitism is clearly part of it, but by no means the thrust of the project. It's about tolerance. And if you expect tolerance, you have to show tolerance. Otherwise, it becomes very obnoxious. Well, they are obnoxious, but they don't seem to know it. And anti-Semitism is the thrust of the project. They just want to kind of slip it in there and say it's not really about that, but it's about tolerance. And then he says, if you expect tolerance, you have to show tolerance. This has been repeated many times. I think some others have said it too. Well, Jews and Israel do not show tolerance. Jews nowhere do Jews show tolerance. They expect tolerance for themselves, but does any of this stuff that they're doing, does it show tolerance to others? They're absolutely intolerant. And they have the chutzpah, you see, as they always do, to just come out with something like that and think that because they say it, people will say, oh, they won't be able to think, well, they wouldn't absolutely blatantly lie like that, would they, about themselves? But of course they do, or else they don't know it. But I don't think they can not know it. I think they just like to make bold, dishonest, wrongful statements and just walk away after they've done it. The document, a European Framework National Statute for the Promotion of Tolerance, according to the drafters, seeks to define, codify, or codify and balance rights, liberties, and security at a time when governments are scrambling over how to cope. This is how they present it. They're trying to help, you see. Governments are having a hard time coping with this multiculturalism and immigration and so on, which they are, for some reason, forced to accept and think that they should, for some reason, if they do. And so this document is trying to help them figure out how to do it. And this is the way to do it. This is the way to bring about tolerance in all of society, so that these problems can be solved, as though they're going to be solved that way, which of course they won't be. But you'll have a lot of people in jail and other people afraid to say anything, and that's how you'll solve it. And society will go down the drain. I mean, social order will go down the drain. But The Guardian says it goes much further, calling for the criminalization of overt approval of a totalitarian ideology, xenophobia, and anti-Semitism. So there's another area that it covers, that if you show approval outwardly, not just in your own mind or in your own house, but if you're out in public and you show approval of a totalitarian ideology, what does that mean? Nazism, right? You think they're going to care if you show approval of communism? No. But Nazism, Adolf Hitler, National Socialism, if you want to put it that way, that will be a crime to approve of that. Can you imagine? I can't imagine. I can't imagine living like that. Well, it goes on. Again, to the education and tolerance, it would be mandatory from primary school to university, and also for the military and the police, which is already going on. And while public broadcasting, we must devote time to that. I already said that. And here's the important part. The drafters of this, these men I named, are currently touring the parliaments. I imagine it's mostly Dinstein, though. He's the only one you hear about. They're touring the parliaments of Europe, trying to drum up support for a consensus that would get many, if not all, of the proposals turned into law across 28 countries. This is what they're after. They want all of them. Well, we know that what are called the Holocaust denial laws and the anti-racist laws and so on are different in different European countries. And some don't have them at all. Some have a mild form. Some have a very severe form of them. But they want it to be uniform all over the European Union. They want the European Union to accept this and to enforce it throughout every country. You might think that this is impossible, and at the moment, it's not going to happen. But as I said before, keep in mind that they never give up, and they usually accomplish what they set out to accomplish eventually. This could happen, and it could happen within 5-10 years. It could, or something absolutely different could happen. But the other option here is to really support, hope that there will be growth in the support of things like the Front National in France and the UKIP in Britain. Now, these are not perfect organizations, but I think that they would stand up against this kind of thing. And so they're, if they're real, But that's, you know, that's the only hope that can be given out at this point. And now it does point out, and you may have heard that in Hungary, they took it to the Hungarian government. I don't know if they talked to Orbán or not, but it's considered by them to be a nationalist right-wing government. And they laughed at it there and said they wouldn't touch it with a long pole. So Hungary is out at the moment. And it was also, they also talked with Britain's UK Independence Party, UKIP, and that party was strongly opposed to it. So that's good news. But they say here that these organizers are particularly keen to see Britain enact legislation similar to that in Germany or Austria, criminalizing Holocaust denial. "We very much regret this is not done by Britain," he said. I guess so. But I wouldn't take too much confidence from things like this, because I think that we need to have a plan. And there's a lot of differences even in people wanting to even discuss Holocaust or even talk about it. But I would say pro-European people we need to have a better plan to on how to go about destroying things like this framework, destroying it altogether, saying we're never going to have anything like this, and causing these people to go away and not come around lobbying in Europe for this kind of legislation. This is what's needed, not just to say, well, they're not going to get it anywhere here or in this country or that country or the other country, but they're getting somewhere. They might get somewhere in some of the countries, and they're organized and they have a plan. May not be the best plan, but it's the best one that they have going for them, because everything they do is lies and irrational, based on irrational foundation. Okay, here's another thing where they say their yardstick for wanting it to be everywhere and adopted by all the countries of Europe is that it should be that if an international tribunal has ruled that genocide has taken place, it should be accepted everywhere in Europe as a criminal conduct to contest that in public. See? Incredible. So if that's just another way of saying that if the International Tribunal at Nuremberg back in 1945-46, they ruled that genocide of Jews had taken place. I don't know if they used, I think they did use that language there. But it wasn't accepted everywhere. But they wanted so that would be accepted everywhere and be criminal to contest it. You know, to be criminal to make it a crime to be anti-Semitic, which this would also do, it would be a crime to express any anti-Semitism. That's not the case today, except in a few countries. That's what was going on in Russia, in Bolshevik Soviet Russia. As soon as the Bolsheviks took over, they enacted that law. What are we talking about? 1917, 1919. Anyway, during that time, until later in the more Stalinist days. I think that was no longer carried out, but for a while it was a criminal, and you could be arrested, you could even be put to death for expressing anti-Semitic views. So this is what a Jewish-run European nation would be, where it would be so extreme that everything, anything that didn't fit what they wanted in their little, their big narrative, you would have no mercy. You know, it'd be impossible for you to ever oppose it. And this again, let's go to the next step here. This means that there'd be no way to oppose anything that the Jews are protecting, are making illegal in order to protect themselves. No way. There'd be no way, just like there's no way today in Europe, or at least in a number of countries, to to oppose or to question the Holocaust, there would be no way to question anything or oppose anything at all. You'd be a complete white folks like me and you would be a complete servant. You'd be a complete slave. And all of them, everyone. So this is the most take this to its logical extreme and see what it would be. It's just enough to it's even worse than 1984, really. But that would, even if it was that bad, you know, that's what they want, and that's why these people, these Jewish people, you know, we cannot allow it. Them to get to manage to make themselves protected like they want to be, because they present themselves as victims of Europe, and therefore Europe has a duty to protect them at all costs and in every way. And we cannot allow that. We cannot allow Jews to be protected, because Jews are the force of all this bad and evil destruction and genocide of white people. They are. And people who say don't talk about the Jews, and there's plenty of them who think that they're fighting for Europe, but they don't want to talk about the Jews. They're living in a delusional world. They're not accomplishing anything. And I tell you, most of the people in what is supposed to be the white movement, I don't know, it's a terrible, there's no way to call it anything, and certainly white nationalists are the biggest, they've accomplished nothing as far as I'm concerned. There were some good things accomplished in determining racial issues and so on in the early part of the century, and maybe before that, there, going back a ways, there was a lot of good things, but for a long time now, the white nationalist movement has been nothing, just nothing, and accomplishing nothing. And then you have the part of them won't talk about Jews and don't want to talk about Jews. So that doesn't get anywhere. But you have to talk about Jews in the right way. You can't just go into dirty language and attack. It doesn't come across well. It requires real education. And in a way that you can reach people who don't understand the situation yet. You have to reach a lot of people. Or at least you have to get enough of a vanguard going that can do something. But right now it's all confused and it's all mixed up and kind of a mess. And nobody's together on it. But there's a couple of things here that can't be ignored, that have to be taken into account. And these are the things that there's a whole lot of these white nationalists who they don't want to do it. And that is Jews and the Holocaust. And how many white nationalists think that we should have, the Jews should be counted in with white people? And look what they're doing. Just take a look what these Jews are doing. When you say, well, these are the bad Jews, they'll say there's also good Jews who don't like what these Jews are doing. Maybe they don't like it, but there's not very many of them. And all the power and the money and the big Jewish efforts are into what these people are doing, are into these kinds of projects, to take over. Now, getting back to this Cantor, Moshe Cantor, he complained that when raising the issue of protecting Jews, national and regional Jewish leaders were encouraged to stage fundraising activities. But he says, we shouldn't have to raise funds for our own protection. He says, here's a quote, "We are challenging today things that haven't happened in Europe for 70 years. I don't know. I think that means that this hasn't, they haven't been talking about this for 70 years. They haven't seen Jews as being threatened for 70 years now, since the end of the Holocaust. He says the Jewish community in Europe definitely needs protection. Government should pay and should invest much more money. Government should pay The Jewish community in Europe definitely needs protection. Governments should pay. He says, we've already paid our taxes, and we need much more commitment from governments. Well, this is exactly the same line that Ronald Lauder of the World Jewish Congress was saying at his speech at Auschwitz-Birkenau at the 70th anniversary of the January 27th liberation ceremony. He is saying that the governments, he's telling the Jews in the audience, you know, most of the people there were Jews. He said, you need to force your governments to protect you. Force your governments. Isn't that what they always do? You pay to protect us. You pay. We pay our taxes. You know, we shouldn't have to pay any more than that. We shouldn't have to protect ourselves in your countries. If we're in your countries, you have to protect us. And that's what this whole thing is. That's what Moshe Cantor is saying. And that's what this whole project, this whole statute thing is all about, to say that the governments of Europe have to pass this as a single European Union entity, and that means that they're going to provide all of this. They're going to guarantee all of these rights, and they're going to do it all, and they're going to pay the bill. And it's all going to be for the Jews. But they say, oh, it's not just for us. It's not just for Jews. It's for everyone. But who needs it or wants it except Jews? It certainly is not for Europeans. So as they go on in this deceitful way, it's constantly deception, trying to put something over on us. They're trying to get this support from all 28 countries in Europe, and I covered that. Now, here's finally the names of these four guys, and I'll go over them one more time so that you might remember them. At the end of this framework PDF, it says, this text was prepared under the aegis of the European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation by a group of experts composed of Yoram Dinstein. And Dinstein is a scholar and professor emeritus at Tel Aviv University. He's not, that's it. What is he doing running this council for what should be done in Europe? He's supposedly a specialist on international law and a prominent authority on the laws of war, born in 1936. What's that got to do with this work? Nothing. He's a Jew from Tel Aviv University. This Ugo Genesio, or Genesio, is a former Supreme Court justice in Italy, suspected Jewish. See, they have to wonder how they get these people, if they're not Jewish, to be on these committees. Another one is Rein Müllersen, but I couldn't find any information on him. He's like an unknown person. Another is Daniel Thurer, Thurer, like Führer, kind of only Thurer. He's Swiss. He's a jurist and professor emeritus of international comparative constitutional and European law at the University of Zurich. He was born in 1945, see, right at the end of the war. They want him because he has a big reputation, or he's a, you know, respectable international law expert, and supposedly he can help to make this framework work out so that it's legal. But I don't see too much legal language in it. Then the last one is Rüdiger Wolfram, a German from a professor of international law at Heidelberg University, Faculty of Law, and also with the Max Planck Institute for Comparative Public Law and International Law, and he was born in 1941. What's interesting here is that they brought in these people who are experts on international law. And because, see, everything with the Jews are always international. And this is to be something that is valid internationally, and they think in terms of international. Europe is international, and Europe is going to follow these. They need to follow international law of forms and requirements and so on. But I don't see, as I said, I don't see any of this worked out here. Here's a section on migrants. If a foreign migrant who has been admitted into the territory of the state but has not acquired citizenship is clearly unwilling to comply with the principle of coexistence of diverse groups within a single national society, he or she may be obliged to leave the state. Okay, so now they're saying, well, now if these migrants don't behave themselves, they'll have to leave. Well, who's going to make them leave? Because they have some explanatory notes here even, that of course it has to be subject to applicable international legal standards, and there's already a protection under the Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of European Convention that says no one shall be expelled from the territory of the state of which he is a national. So if the migrant has acquired nationality already, that doesn't apply. If you're not a national, you have to bear in mind that the collective expulsion of aliens is prohibited under Article 4 of the same protocol, and the decision whether a new migrant has forfeited the right to remain within the state must therefore be made on an individual basis through an appropriate judicial or quasi-judicial procedure. You see, who has the money to spend on the judicial process for all of these migrants that might be misbehaving on an individual basis, especially when they're bringing in migrants from Africa and islands and so on, people who are completely foreign to Europe, and yet if they misbehave or don't practice tolerance to the rest of the other people there, then you're going to have to go through all this legal wrangle on an individual basis, and they're going to get lawyers, and they're given to them, and they're going to have every possibility to find loopholes of one sort or another. It's already set up that way. It's not, none of this stuff works, will ever work the way they say in the very first sections of it, you know. Section 5, migrants, A, B, C. You know, this is the way it goes. Now, then they have all these exclusions and explanatory notes on almost every one of them. And this would be overly expensive to deal with. None of it's possible. I don't know. And here you've got these international law experts on this committee. What's going on here? Why do these people do this? Oh, here's a good commentary from another website that's called Islam versus Europe. And I just copied this down because I thought it was pretty good. He writes, I wrote before about the EU's latest madcap totalitarian project, the European Framework National Statute for the Promotion of Tolerance, that this isn't the EU's project, though, you see. Maybe he understands that now, because this is the ECTR project trying to get the European Union to go along with it. But see, this is how they can fool people. People don't even know what it is because of the titles they give themselves and the titles they give to their papers that they write. But he says European framework thing, that includes group libel provisions designed to enforce tolerance by intolerantly suppressing the slightest murmuring of dissent. What I failed to notice, he says, was that this draft legislation had been authored by a group that was chaired by an Israeli professor. It's reasonable to ask why Europeans are to have their speech and thought criminalized by legislation drafted by a foreign national. Well, see, there he came to the realization that the people who were behind this were not Europeans who wanted to enforce all these rules on other Europeans or on themselves. No, it's by these sneaky Jews, by these sneaky Israelis. And there are too many, there are people going, letting them add their names to what they're doing. People who are Europeans who are letting them add, letting their names be added to what these people are doing. But when you look, people who say, it's not all the Jews, it's not the Jews, you know, don't always look at the Jews. But you know what? If you, every one of these things and everything that goes on that is of this nature, if you look far enough, you always find, you always find that the originators of it, where it started, is Jews. So everything about criminalizing Holocaust denial and criminalizing anti-Semitism and all that they add to it, intolerance and so on, is it's the Jews who are behind all of this. The Jews are behind it because it's the Jews that want to protect themselves. And they other groups of people might not be liked, might be unpopular, and they form organizations to make them, you know, to promote a better image of themselves and things like that. And that's legitimate. They do that, but they don't go to the extent that Jews go to in the number, for one thing. Thousands of organizations that they're behind. And the fact that they are so adamantly behind stopping Holocaust denial also shows that they are the reason they are behind a Holocaust. They are the creators of the Holocaust because the Holocaust is their crown jewel. It benefits them more than anything else in existence. That is the one thing, and they want to say that oh, it's about the gypsies and it's about other Europeans and it's about this and about that. That oh, it's about intolerance. It's about totalitarianism. No, it's only about how they can benefit from what has come to be called the Holocaust. How they can benefit from that and their whole benefit. Yeah, the massive benefits they've enjoyed since World War II are all based on the beliefs about the Holocaust that came out in the Nuremberg Tribunal. And who helped them do that so much? The Russians, the Soviets, I'll say, the Soviet Union, communism, the communists, and then the Western military, the military of especially United States and Britain, because of all the war crimes that they committed. And then Churchill and Roosevelt, who was now dead, but were approving of all these war crimes. And so they had their big stake in it too. But the ones who still have such a stake in it, the others don't, are not, I don't think they're so actively trying to hold it all together anymore. It is the Jews and their state of Israel. That's who is behind the whole thing. That those are the culprits. That's where to look. And so there's no getting around it. Now, speaking of Jews in Israel, in the, 15. Oh, I don't have time. Let me get my show back on here. Well, I won't. I was going to talk about why I say that I think Jews should go to Israel when so many people say, oh, don't say that because look at you sending them all down to those poor Palestinians. Well, I think that they belong in the Middle East. That's where they're from. They're Semites. I don't care about this Khazar theory business. They come from the Middle East. That's where they belong, and they can fight it out down there with the Semites, all the rest of the Semites who live there, and without the help of the United States. If we could just stop the United States and Europe from helping Israel, we could maybe do something about this situation. And that's the answer as far as I'm concerned. Maybe I'll go into that another time or write about it a little bit. But for now, I'm going to say good night. Thanks for listening tonight. And do remember to pay attention to this statement that's been going around, and pay attention to this show and to what Andrew Joyce wrote at Occidental Observer. Good night.